This podcast is a production of KCRW and KCRW.com Santa Monica. If you enjoy this program, check out KCRW.com for more than 20 additional programs that you can podcast.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Best of The Business, in honor of the writer's strike and to celebrate his new hit movie, I Am Legend, we'll revisit our conversation with the Oscar-winning scribe, Akiva Goldsman. We talk about the vital and disposable Hollywood writing. Then, 'tis the season for Hollywood gifting. From the town that brings new meaning to the phrase, ho, 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 it's The Business from NPR. An off-quoted scene in the Coen Brothers' 1991 classic, Barton Fink, gives you a sense of how the business often views the screenwriter. In the scene, a writer, played by John Turturro, pleads for help from his producer, played by Tony Shalhoub, over lunch in the studio commissary.
Just having trouble getting started. It's funny, I'm blocked up. I just feel like I need some kind of indication of what's expected.
Wallace Beery, wrestling picture. What do you need, a roadmap? Look, you're confused. You need guidance? Talk to another writer.
Who?
Oh, Jesus. You throw a rock in here, you'll hit one. Do me a favor, Fink. Throw it hard.
Like it or not, every movie needs a writer. And in many cases, maybe even most cases, it ends up being a gaggle of writers. Scribes are often hired and fired as a project moves from development to the screen. And for every written-by credit on a major Hollywood film, there can be an equal number of writers who didn't get credit, even though they made some significant contributions. The new film I Am Legend arrived in theaters this month to the highest December weekend opening in history. This massive hit is also a great case study in how movies struggle to be made and how screenwriters often bear the brunt of that struggle. Richard Matheson's 1954 science fiction novel of the same name had already been adapted into two films over the years when a writer named Mark Protasevich penned a dark new version that was picked up by Warner Brothers in the late 1990s. Ridley Scott agreed to direct, and Arnold Schwarzenegger was set to star. But the project was shelved by the studio as costs started to skyrocket. I Am Legend became the stuff of legend for the way it bounced around Hollywood for years until a writer and director named Akiva Goldsman got his hands on it almost a decade later. Goldsman won the Academy Award for adapting the book A Beautiful Mind for the screen. He wrote a version of I Am Legend and nabbed frequent collaborator Will Smith to star. Smith then asked for a script incorporating some of Mark Protasevich's original draft from the 1990s and some of Goldsman's new adaptation. In his role as producer, Goldsman then rehired Protasevich to create a shooting script. They both have screenplay credit. But perhaps seven writers in all took a whack at I Am Legend in the intervening decades. And that means writers were hired and fired for reasons that probably had nothing to do with writing. As a writer himself, even Oscar winner Akiva Goldsman knows what it's like to get canned. And he's worked on major films for which he's not gotten credit. But he's also a producer, so he understands both sides of the equation. We spoke with him earlier this year in his offices on the Warner's lot in Burbank. Akiva Goldsman, welcome to The Business.
Thank you.
Is it possible anymore for one writer to have an idea, write it up, and see it go on screen?
Absolutely. Writers move around the merry-go-round of participation in large part as a result of people's fear, not because they can't do the job. Writing is a very odd piece of the movie business because it is traditionally kept outside of the production component. This is a historical short-sightedness, and there's a tendency on the part of writers to not know how to interact with production simply because they've never learned how to participate in the collaborative component of the process. And I think there is a tendency for production to find writers to be those weird guys who send in pages. And in all fairness, it's absurd. Costume designers design, then interact and redesign. Writers are, on the whole, able to write, interact, and rewrite. They are just often not given the chance. Writers can be threatening and annoying. And self-loathing. We're a fantastic bunch. But we're funny. I think that to write, you know, you got to kind of pretend that the world will obey you, right? I mean, you got to sort of sit there at the blank screen and go, well, now she'll say that. And of course, production doesn't work that way. And what happens is writers are so used to being by themselves that the transition to then interacting and modifying what they're doing, you know, which is about criticism and modulation of creative product, is hard. Nobody likes to be told that they didn't do it perfectly the first time. You actually have to learn that it's part of your job.
Given all that, I mean, what are some of the reasons given to writers, both real and the reasons that are given to writers that are made up, for why they're being replaced?
Well, I think the truth behind it is generally that movies are sort of this competing convergence of fear and conviction. On a given day, fear or conviction wins. And when people are in their most frightened, they move the thing that is easier to move. And there is literally a convention in Hollywood of replacing writers. You don't hear about a string of costume designers, a string of production designers, a string of location managers being replaced on every movie. You've never heard of it. But everybody knows writers get replaced all the time. It's the weakest link, simply systemically. It's become traditionally the weakest link, so people bear down on it and break it. What they say to you is, we want to go in another direction. You know, we feel like you've gotten it almost all the way there. You know, we have somebody who's very good with the way she sounds. You know, he's got a kind of comedy that really works if he interacts with this guy that he, you know, we think you've given your best to them. Are you burnt out? I mean, and literally there, and it's fantastic because honestly, there are things you wouldn't say to your 9-year-old. You'd actually just go, can you do any better? Which a step which is often skipped in the writer replacement merry-go-round. By the way, sometimes writers get replaced because they're bad or because they haven't mustered up the creative stuff that the scene requires. It's okay for anybody to be replaced in any job if they're not doing the job. The problem is it's so hard to define the job because it's about a creative point of view that really the only way it's ever going to work is if people are collaborative and talk to each other about what the expectations and the needs of the object, the screenplay, are.
What's the handoff like from one writer to another? I mean, do you ever seek out, I know you for this movie you did reach out to Mark Protasevich, but I mean, how common is it? Would it be weird for a writer to call up one who just finished the project?
We all do it all the time now, as much as possible.
Really?
Absolutely. I didn't do it once years ago. On an adaptation, I replaced somebody, and they were so crestfallen, heartbroken. It never occurred to me. It was a book. I didn't think it could matter that much, and it was so naive of me. I realized how upset the first writer was, and from that moment on, I generally won't come on. I rarely will come on to anything that's active at all, even if it's dead, I will call the original writer. It's pretty grim. It's a pretty bad feeling. It's happened to me a couple of times, and it's heartbreaking.
Part of the call is seems to be courtesy, that there's this fraternity among writers. How much of it is that, and how much of it is just a need to speak with someone who has just also, you know, been to the front lines of that project?
Generally, when you come onto a project later in the process, or you know, when you're replacing somebody, hopefully you're only doing it because it's going in such a wildly different direction. So it's not really that much about, gee, did you try that? I've done that a couple of times. Ron Bass and I used to do that on Geisha, a project which neither of us have credit on, but we're both writers on it sequentially. And we certainly, you know, a couple of times talked about the object and creatively. And Mark Protasevich and I talk a lot.
How much work can you do on a project and still not get credit for it?
As a writer?
Yeah.
Almost all of it.
Really?
Yeah. Our guild has a real vulnerability when it comes to the credit process. I have been unbelievably lucky. I don't have a movie that I could complain about. That's remarkably rare for someone who's been around as many pictures as I have. As a writer, you can, and I know people well who have done great work, truly great work, who are not credited for it, who are contractually precluded from talking about it by the guild, who can never own it, who can never claim it. And it's heart-killing.
You're not contractually prohibited, are you? I mean, you could tell us.
I could. If they were movies that I were involved with, I would.
Oh, you know? Okay.
I'll tell you this. And now I'll violate the minimum basic agreement. A fellow named Charlie Mitchell is as fundamental a contributor to Cinderella Man as any writer. He's a fantastic screenwriter who spent years working on that screenplay and created the object that so many of us were attracted to. It happens all the time.
That's cold comfort if you're Charlie Mitchell. Can he go out and say, well, look, here are my drafts of...
Everybody knows. You can. Everybody within the business knows. And it is cold comfort.
So has Charlie Mitchell ever been able to benefit from that and say, be hired because of the script he wrote, even though that nobody in America knows?
Sure. I think it helps him get work, but it doesn't help him as much as if he were credited for it. I mean, everybody tells you, and it's a self-soothing system that takes place within the construct of Hollywood. Look, everybody knows, everybody knows, everybody knows. This is what you hear when you're wondering whether you're going to get credit or... sure, everybody knows, but not really.
I'm curious, what is it like for you? I mean, you know, part of your day hopefully is spent saying, I'm Akiva Goldsman, Oscar-winning screenwriter for A Beautiful Mind. You can't do this to me. But you've been fired. What's the process like for you? What happens after that? Do you?
And by the way, yes, I spend all my days going, I'm Akiva Goldsman, to my wife, who also doesn't care. Some years ago, right after I had won the Academy Award, I got a project that I was working on, a project here called Superman versus Batman, was abandoned. We were in pre-production.
Pre-production means sets are being built.
Yeah.
Costumes are being fitted.
Yeah.
This is not a theoretical enterprise anymore.
It was not a theoretical enterprise. And I was actually just polishing up a script, a really, really well-written script, but was working quite hard on it. They shut the project down. And I remember calling Ron Howard, and I said, I get it now. None of it's personal. Because if there's any day where I can tell myself I don't suck, it's today, and I'm still getting shut down. So the fact is, the business is just the business. And up until that moment, whenever something had happened, I would always say to myself, if I were just a little better, if I were just a little more recognized, if critics liked it, or if it made a little more money, or if the last one had just, then this bad thing wouldn't happen to me. And on that day, it was weirdly liberating because I realized it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter what awards you have. It doesn't matter what you've written before. You are as subject to the vagaries of this business as anybody else. And we're paid a lot to take it on the chin. Sometimes in Hollywood it's personal, but sometimes everywhere it's personal. I mean, the fact is, you know, ultimately people will tolerate your being a dick until you don't have power. And then they will slaughter you. Which has always been so interesting to me because it so obviously means don't be a dick. Because eventually, you know, probably Thursday next, I will stumble, fall down, and I will need somebody who was subordinate to me then to hire me later. Everybody remembers everything. And we pretend we don't because it's the politics of the business. But nobody's forgotten a single thing ever about the way somebody treated them.
Akiva Goldsman, thanks for being on The Business.
Thanks, it was fun. I am legend, and that chimes when you walk alone.
That's a friend of fire to make the stand. After I Am Legend raked in the bucks its first weekend, you can bet a fancy gift basket, or 10, arrived at the bungalow of writer and producer Akiva Goldsman. In fact, there are 4 opportunities for gifting in Hollywood. The first is the milestone, a big opening, deal signed, project completed. Second are birthdays, anniversaries, that sort of stuff. Third, the ever-popular apology gift. But the mother of all gifting times is the holidays. Gifts that say, I want you to need me as much as I need you. Or something like that. We've made a holiday tradition of speaking with Variety's Dana Harris about the treacherous landscape of Hollywood gifting. We talked to her originally in 2005. Dana Harris, welcome to the business.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit, first of all, what is the standard protocol? Is there one for what you have to give and who you have to gift?
Gifts are a very complicated cultural issue in Hollywood. At the very lowest level, you are obliged to give a greeting card to anybody you may or may not have met who may be of some use to you in the year ahead. And that's a pretty awesome list of people. The idea is basically a stamp is cheap, cards are cheap. Wouldn't you rather not take the chance of offending somebody? The next level is when you have a client or a producer or even a sound mixer who you value, and you're obliged to give them a gift of some ilk. And then it goes up from there up to the very top, the toppermost, the Tom Cruises, the Tom Hanks, the Reese Witherspoons, that there's a concern that if you don't give them the right gift, that you somehow are going to cause irreparable damage to your relationship. It's a very fraught time.
So what is the caste system? That is, if I am, say, a star on a WB show, what might I get? Is there a sort of high-end and low-end minimums? Are there goalposts to aim for so that we do not offend the delicate sensibilities?
There's always a goalpost to aim for, but it changes from year to year. Last year's goalpost was the iPod. But the only problem was that if you were a, you know, B, C-level star, you could very easily wind up with a half a dozen iPods.
Do you know of instances where this
happens? I do know of instances when people have wind up with half a dozen iPods and they're giving them to their assistants, they're giving them to their assistants' assistants, and it really makes the whole process, you know, seem like a farce, which it is anyway.
On one level, it must be comforting because if you just became, say, a working actor on a show, then you go, I've arrived. I've gotten to the iPod level.
Yes, absolutely. And that's a point where people say, okay, now I know I must be of some value to you. And really, that's the main problem in terms of the whole gifting ritual, is that it's not so much that you want to give someone a gift because you care about them. It's that you know that even at the highest levels, there is a paranoia that's built in that what happens if they don't care about me anymore? What if they don't worry about me? What if I'm no longer that person? Because they need to know that you're thinking about them. They need to know that they have not been forgotten, that if you are one of the 20 female stars at CAA, and I'm actually being kind there, I'm sure they have many more than 20, that you have been thought of because, oh my God, otherwise they could have given gifts to the other 19. And if they gave those gifts to them, they're probably giving them scripts to them. And if they're giving them scripts, I'm not getting those scripts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
The downward spiral.
The downward spiral.
So is there a difference between, say, what I would give an executive versus what I would give a producer versus another agent or another manager or, you know?
There's all sorts of levels for this. I mean, and I would not pretend to be a professional in this, nor would I want to be. There are people who are very highly paid in this area and have made entire businesses out of how to gift people. There's a place called The Art of the Gift that specializes in trying to find gifts that aren't going to be re-gifted, that are going to wind up being kept by people, that will make people feel special.
But it's comedic on the face of it.
It's ridiculous.
Because as far as I know, Jerry Bruckheimer actually owns a town in Kentucky.
Correct.
Doesn't he?
Need has nothing to do with this. This is all about that you care about this person. It has nothing to do with actually needing the stuff.
After a short break, more with Variety's Dana Harris about the holidays in Hollywood, the place where gifting is a verb. Stick around. It's The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. The holidays in Hollywood could be described as peace on earth, goodwill towards men, and a basket of expensive wine and fancy chocolate. I'm talking to Variety's Dana Harris about the politics of gifting in Hollywood. We talked to her originally in 2005. Now, the thing I have to ask about, just as a reporter, I mean, we both worked at Variety for years. You still are here. The logo issue. You know, regularly you would get, come Christmas time, not only cards from people you'd never met or barely remembered,
but you would
receive a beautiful bauble from Tiffany's, generally. And it was a beautiful box, or it was a beautiful piece of crystal, which had on it, you know, from your friends at Schmegma Co.
Film processing.
And I think to myself, not only do I have no friends there, I don't even remember setting foot in this company. And yet now you have this...
Emblazoned on your desk, this
Tiffany box from, you know, right. Schmecky's Schlubby Schlubovitz Film Processing or Sound Mixing or whatever. Is there... To logo or not to logo? Is that something people wrestle with anymore?
Oh, absolutely. Logoing is a verb. Logoing is a real verb, and that is something that people I've talked to in the business who, again, make a business out of figuring out how to give gifts in Hollywood is to how to logo. If you should logo, should one logo in this manner or that manner? Is there a way to do it subtly? Those are real significant issues that people have because they want people. Again, they want logos on their gifts for the same reason they want their name on the credits. I want proof that I did this. They have to have that. They want their pound of flesh too. If they're going to be giving you a beautiful baccarat paperweight, you are going to damn well know where that paperweight came from.
A paperweight by P.T. Anderson.
Correct.
There's a certain remove that people are doing all this important gift giving. In all likelihood, they never saw the gift they sent.
In almost all likelihood, it truly is at a remove. I mean, which is one of the things that I personally find so creepy about the whole process, you know, because as a reporter, you know, you are most of the gifts that you get, which is, you know, just fine, thanks, we don't want anything, are greeting cards. And one of the reasons I hate these greeting cards is because they are so completely impersonal.
What's curious, though, is that nobody has time in this business. Everyone is pressed for time, harassed for time. You go to drinks with someone, they're checking their voicemail, they're checking their BlackBerry. They can't let one know, yes, it has to, you know, be fired off with their crackberry in their hand. Why not write someone a note? Why not say something like, you know, I'm taking the time, taking 15 minutes out of the day to sort of emphasize to you, you know, what our relationship means. Wouldn't that be more valuable?
You would think that. But you have to remember the level of paranoia here is that if someone gives a gift of a letter, for instance, the thought is not going to be, my God, how kind, how heartwarming. The thought is going to be, that son of a bitch. He doesn't want to take the time to go get the guy from Barney's to do this. And he thinks he's going to pawn me off on this cheap piece of stationery. That's going to be the thought.
It's very nice stationery. But, you know, you're right, and I think that probably would be the reaction, and I think part of the reason might be also because people are so pressed for time, what they want is not your time, they want their time, right?
Correct.
They want 2 hours at Burke Williams, you know, to be rubbed and pampered, or someone to...
Of course, the absurdity is, though, is that we, in this business, there people who are able to go to spas and what have you, they have all that stuff to the nth degree. The real kind of time that they want to have is truly only a gift they're going to be able to give themselves. There's no one in the world who can give that to them.
Dana Harris, thanks for being on The Business.
My pleasure.
Things have changed a lot since 2005, so we decided to call Dana Harris to get an update. After all, polar caps are melting and writers are frozen out. So, Dana, when last we spoke, it was 2005, and the iPod was de rigueur. You could not really be a person of any import in Hollywood and not receive at least, you know, 20 of them from somebody who wanted to kiss your butt.
Mm-hmm.
What's the new iPod?
Well, the new iPod is still sort of the iPod. I think what's changed, though, is that to get 20 iPods, you can actually be on the B list. And get 20 iPods, as opposed to in 2005, you had to be on the A-list to get the 20 iPods.
So there's a strike going on in Hollywood. The writers are walking the picket lines. How has the strike changed gift-giving?
It's kind of hard to tell at this point, but I think there was any year that it was appropriate to either skip gift-giving or to just go really small, even to the point of a card. This would be the one where people would let it slide. I mean, it's really hard to be oversized in your gestures when you've got a strike going on.
Now, is part of that just that the agency budgets are just not there anymore?
That's part of it, certainly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's also just a level of, believe it or not, in Hollywood, just pure tact. I mean, it just budgets are certainly part of it, though. I mean, and especially because no one can see clearly as to when the strike is going to end, and you know, the real layoffs haven't even begun, if presuming the strike continues.
Mm-hmm. So what about writers? Are they getting any gifts this year? Are they getting extra gifts because they're suffering?
I don't think the writers probably would be getting extra gifts. No, I really don't think they would, because it's from whom? It sure isn't going to be from the studios. Yeah.
Well, I would think maybe the agencies want to, you know, take extra special care of their guys while they're out.
Oh, they'll give them a churro and they'll be happy about it. I mean,
it's just writers. Let's talk about the greening of Hollywood. How is that changing the nature of gift giving, both, you know, to you and to everybody else?
Well, I think it's changed on two levels. One is cheaper to, you know, it's cheaper for them to make a donation in your name than it is to order the bottle of booze and have it delivered. It's, you know, in terms of, and now it's something that's acceptable. They're not being cheap. They're being environmentally proactive.
You know what's even cheaper than that is saying that you gave a gift in your name, but not doing that at
all. Who's going to check? But the other thing is that it's also opened up a whole area of gifts. It's opened up a whole realm of possibilities for what you can give somebody, because it's almost like if you give something that is very apparently green, such as bamboo fiber bed sheets. Now, bed sheets, unless you're giving, say, Frite linens or something, that's something that nobody's going to be getting as a gift for, you know, on any level. It's just too weird to be giving bed sheets. If the bamboo fiber thing pushes it to a different level, because it's like saying, look how environmentally conscious I am, look how, you know, on top of things I am, how thoughtful I am, I'm trying to maintain your life on the planet. There's a whole, because there's a huge, huge industry in eco-luxury products. It's enormous.
Mm-hmm.
And
which is kind of funny that the culture of the most gross excess is suddenly, you know, into sustainability.
Exactly. But exactly. They in, for some weird reason, at the moment, they're going hand in hand. So more than anything else, I think it's just opened up a whole new venue for gift giving, because it's like now there's all these categories that were once like you would just never consider. But it's like now, oh, but it's green. Mm-hmm. So it becomes much more attractive.
All right. Well, we hope you have a great holiday. Dana Harris, the editor of Variety.com. Thanks for being on The Business.
Thanks a lot.
Hollywood holiday. I said it once before and I'll say it again. Yes, I said it all before. I don't want this night to end. Hollywood holiday.
And that's The Business. Matt Holtzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
And he falls and he lies on the floor in the darkness. The air conditioners hum. She lies in wait for what's to come. Hollywood holiday. I said it once before, I'll say it again. Yes, I said it.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.